The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. The theme of this retreat, concentration and insight. That's kind of one of those basic themes in our practice. And for the beginning of the retreat, the emphasis in the morning instruction was concentration practice, and the afternoon was on insight. And these two are partners in the practice that we do here in Buddhist practice, working together. One of my favorite ways of kind of entry point for understanding concentration and insight has to do with how the Chinese, when they received Buddhism from India, they had to figure out what Chinese words and characters in which to translate the Indian words. And so the Indian words for concentration and insight is samadhi and vipassana. And the Chinese chose the character, the word for stopping, to translate concentration, and the word for seeing for insight. Makes some sense. But the idea of stopping for concentration is a little bit maybe unusual. But that's a big part of the function of concentration, is to help the mind slow down, maybe to stop. Certainly stop some of the normal activities that some of our minds are capable of being involved in. And so a big and what that allows is the mind slows down and stops, then it's possible to see more clearly. When things are going really fast, it's hard to tell what's going on. This is why they have replays in sports, and you say slow it down and they watch carefully. And so, you know, in a sense, we have this, you know, we're cultivating the, I don't know if you just want to say the replay button, but we're cultivating the ability to slow down and see much more clearly what actually goes on in our life as it's unfolding. The analogy to a replay button is kind of interesting because mostly what you're doing is replaying anyway. And so this, you know, you slow down, you can kind of see it more carefully and understand what's happening. So, you know, for many people, the beginning of a retreat or meditation practice has a lot to do with being surprised by what you encounter when you slow down, when you take a look. Sometimes we discover the tremendous momentum of the mind, the activity of the mind, the concerns of the mind and the heart that maybe are not so obvious as we go about our daily life. And so there's a lot of taking a long, hard look at oneself that happens when you sit and meditate. And sometimes it does feel hard. It's difficult to look and see what's there. And sometimes it's just difficult to even look because the mind is spinning out so fast. So to slow down enough so we can really take an honest and clear look at what's going on here is part of the function of meditation. Many people associate the value of meditation with the concentration side, calming down, relaxing, de-stressing. And that's certainly valuable. But in Buddhism, the function of slowing down, concentration, stabilizing, is not for its own sake, but rather for how it helps us to do the second part, which is the insight part, to see clearly. And the hope is that it doesn't remain a long, hard look at oneself, but rather becomes a long, soft look at oneself. That somehow, as we go along, the way in which we look, the way in which we're present for ourselves, begins to change. And this is one of the important secrets, or I don't know secrets, but keys of meditation practice, is at some point you want to be able to turn around 180 degrees and notice what the mind is like that's doing the looking, that's doing the watching. People often we're so focused on what we're looking at, what we're concerned about, what we're thinking about, that we don't really notice the quality of the mind that has its concerns, the mind that's reaching out, trying to figure out, make its plans for the future, or trying to figure out how to have a better past. All these things the mind is trying to do. But to turn around and look at the how the mind is, not what the mind is about, And so you might notice there's maybe emotions that are there that are connected to how we are, how we're paying attention. There's motivations of all kinds you didn't know, striving, wanting to get, resistance, clinging, desires, being for, being against what you're aware of. And so as we slow down, take this long, soft look, we begin seeing how we are, how we're looking, how we're paying attention, how we're relating to our experience. And that helps us then to soften. And the mind, the awareness begins to soften. And one of the characteristics of a concentrated mind is a mind that is soft and pliable. And also, it's bright. There's kind of a luminosity in the mind as it softens and opens. People who try to get concentrated by having a hard mind usually end up with a brittle mind. And it usually becomes kind of fragile, and sometimes it can actually be problems because they're pushing so much. But the hope is that as insight develops, we take more responsibility for the quality of the mind, how we are, so it softens and relaxes. It doesn't soften, and so we lose our vigilance, the vigilance that keeps us from wandering off in thought, but softens so that it becomes easier and easier to see what's here. Then one of the functions of this stopping or slowing down of concentration is so that the activities of the mind begin to slow down. So we're not, you know, going at top speed. And one of the, since I've been teaching a retreat, one of the often told stories at the end of retreats to warn people about going home is a story of the woman who left the retreat, got in a car, and was driving on the freeway, and then she noticed there was a police behind her with the lights flashing. So she pulled over, and an officer walked up to her in a gruff way and said something like, "Lady, do you know how fast you're driving?" And she looked and said, "Oh, I don't know, 70, 75? So then he said something like, "40 miles an hour." On the freeway. And so, you know, sometimes when people are on retreat, things slow down a lot. And so, and people lose sometimes a little perspective. But the idea is to slow down so that our mind slows down, so we're not, you know, racing in there. And as it slows down, and maybe slower than how it normally operates, amazing thing begins to happen. That we start seeing clearly how a thought, a feeling, perception, sensations, and experience that we have arises, and how it passes away. How things are there, things that seem constant when the mind is busy, start seeing as not being constant, solid things, but being a series of events that arise and pass. When things seem solid, it's hard to get at them, it's hard to understand them and look at them. When we see that they arise and we see them pass, then it's easier to see the conditions that bring them about. It's possible to see better what our relationship to it is. And it's possible to begin separating ourselves from it enough so that we are independent from it. We're not caught in the grip of the things that are going on. And that can be quite clear sometimes with physical pain. Physical pain can seem very solid if we kind of relate to it through our concepts and ideas. But when the mind slows down and you're present for pain in a very simple, direct way, you can start seeing that the pain is not solid, but it arises and it passes. It has, you know, maybe quite, you know, continuously, but it's not a solid block of things. Same thing with emotions. It can seem in daily life that, you know, we're just in a particular mood or emotional state all the time, but it's actually rare to have an emotion be constant. There's often interrupted, and other small ones come in, but there might be a background one which is seems more or less constant. But when your mind slows down, you can start seeing that things arise and they pass. They're not so constant. When we see they arise and pass, we can question our relationship to them. So, for example, with the arising and passing of thoughts, you can have if the mind is quiet enough and can watch the birth of a thought, then usually then you can ask, do I need to be involved in this thought? Is this useful for me? And you can kind of feel and sense in that slower mind, the usefulness or the healthiness of being involved in this thought or not involved. And if it's slow enough, you can watch the arising and passing of a thought. It tends to be a lot easier than to let go of it and not be involved, because there's a gap. If the mind is fast and you're seemingly continuously involved, so continuously you don't even know you're involved, you don't see where you're involved, it's going to be hard to let go of it. But when the mind slows down, we have much more control or monitoring, much more choice in relationship to what we think. So there's a whole slew of things we begin understanding and seeing better when things slow down, and that's the function of the concentration. The function of the insight is then to use that slowing down to look more carefully. And then I'll say one more thing about this, and that is insight is not only about seeing what arises and passes, seeing the things of our life more carefully, but it's also seeing, since it's insight, what happens in between the arising and passing. So, for example, something that can be quite maybe challenging or perplexing to understand, especially if your mind is fast and you don't sense can't see this, is represented by the question, when you don't have thoughts, when you don't use thoughts to tell you who you are, who are you? What happens to you? Where are you? Where do you find yourself if you're not going to tell yourself a thought? Most people have a thought or an image by which they represent themselves and understand themselves. So if thoughts are arising and passing, and these thoughts slow down quite a bit, there might actually be short periods of time when there's no thought at all. What happens to all the monumental life problems you have when you don't have a thought to tell you about them? So in that space, what is in that space? We're still alive. Still, there's a kind of an awareness there and presence there. But it's an awareness which is not weighed down or colored by our ideas, our concepts of what is, who we are, who other people are, our history, our identity, many different things. And is there a role in our life for looking at that space where we're alive and aware, but it's not colored or filled with ideas and thoughts? And to begin to have that questioning and looking at that, the contrast begins to pop the bubble of authority that our thoughts and thinking and concepts and ideas often have for us. And we start seeing there's another way, another possibility of how to live our life, how to be. Not that we want to get rid of thoughts and concepts, but we don't have to put all our eggs in that basket. Not everything has to be negotiated through those. Same thing with desires or aversions. When you see that there's a gap, that they're not always there, there's another alternative of how to be, then you don't have to negotiate your life through desires and aversions, which is how some people do all the time. And what is that alternative in the gap when there's no concepts? And if you have no words to tell you what they are, how can you share it with your friends and get credit for it? get wealthy and famous from it. It doesn't do you any good in a certain kind of conventional way, but it provides some of the greatest peace that a person can experience to kind of begin sensing that opening and having that insight. similar to this is also to begin to discern or have insight or seeing into the kind of like the space or kind of like the emptiness that's there when mind doesn't cling. And this is in Buddhism is the ultimate function of concentration and insight, is to discover that which doesn't cling, the mind that doesn't cling. Because clinging is the source, in Buddhism, it's understood as a source of suffering. And so what is that mind like? What is it like, that which doesn't cling? So one of the interesting issues around non-clinging is maybe you have an experience of non-clinging. Have you ever tried clinging to that? People do. Mostly they cling to their idea of it, their concept of, or what they experience, the joy or the peace that they experience in non-clinging. But What happens when you cling to non-clinging? What happens to the non-clinging? It vanishes, right? So how can you get it? You know, if you want to have some, if it's so important, I mean, it provides a great peace, a wonderful peace. It's, you know, incomparable. So you, of course, you want to have it. So you try to grab it. Where does it go? You know, it's kind of like grabbing at, I don't know what it's like, grabbing at air, grabbing at a hologram, you know, or light beam. You try to grab the light beam, you know, through the dust in your living room. you know, there's nothing, you come up empty-handed. And so it's there, but you can't touch it. And so it's kind of, I liken it taking your right hand and trying to touch your right elbow. And it doesn't quite work. You know you have an elbow, but you can't touch it. And so the mind that doesn't cling, this mind that's free, the mind that has insight into freedom, is kind of not something you can directly see, not something you can directly touch. Because as soon as you try to see it, as soon as you try to touch it, you kind of lose it. So how do you see without seeing? How do you touch without touching? So part of the function of this slowing down and seeing is to learn to then trust and relax into a peace, or relax into the space, or relax into the capacity not to be involved or caught in concepts, ideas, desires, and aversions and such things. And it's a beautiful process to be involved in. It's quite something to watch people on retreat, especially, slow down. It's kind of a little bit, you know, it's kind of, sometimes I have to remind people how slow they've gotten, because it happens so slowly, like the woman in the car. Some people think that they're still normal, like, you know, and actually, you know, they've actually slowed down quite a bit, and there's a much greater intimacy and sensitivity and empathy that happens in that slowing down, that it's hard to happen when the mind is speeding up. Okay. I did it. So now it's your turn to ask a question or make a comment or protest. Yes, if you could use the mic, please. Where's the mic? There's over there.
For me, when I can experience non-clinging is when I've actively let go. So if something comes up, I try to experience it in the moment completely and then let it go. And then that's when I can have that feeling of non-clinging.
Great. That's wonderful. So I think that's wonderful that you have that experience. You know that that's a reference point for you. And part of the function of insight, of paying careful attention, is when you have an experience of letting go that's meaningful, experience of non-clinging that's meaningful, we want to actually, you know, you can't quite see it in the normal way perhaps sometimes, but you want to register it, you want to take it in, you want to let yourself, the system, your body and mind, your heart, kind of sense and feel what that's like, appreciate it. Because in the recognition and appreciation, it makes it a little bit easier to then have it as a reference and as a support in the future. It makes it a little bit easier to want to go there, for the not necessarily the mind to want, but the whole system to kind of move in that direction. So it's a good thing. The other thing to say about your wonderful statement is that as there's some modicum of slowing down that happens, some amount of slowing down that happens, and as the insight gets stronger and stronger, it's possible to see and it's an experience that in the, while there's clinging, there can also be non-clinging. That the insight, the seeing itself, you can see clinging, that your mind is clinging, but the seeing itself doesn't cling at all. And that means you don't necessarily have to get rid of anything to be free. You just have to see it with great clarity. And that also is very satisfying. Back there.
Well, you started out by talking about concentration versus insight. For a person like myself who would like to improve the concentration where I'm coming from, are there any specific practices you recommend for that?
For improving concentration?
Yes.
Well, some of it will just come to some degree when you meditate on a regular basis. So just meditating regularly helps that. Some people who want to develop greater concentration in meditation specifically, one of the classic techniques for that is focusing on the breath. And so just staying on the breath and making that basically the only subject for attention. The mind wanders away, you come back. If something else occurs, you just ignore it and come back, and you stay on the breath and relax into the experience of breath, enter into the world of breath, be intimate with the breath. And just do that on a regular basis for a while. Some people find that using breath for concentration practice is supported by counting the breath. And I did that for years because that's how I was taught in Zen. And so, you know, one of the classic ways for that is to count from 1 to 10. Each breath gets a count of 1, 1, 2. And if you lose count, which is pretty likely, then not make any comment, judgments about that. Just start again at 1. And if you get to 32, that also means you've kind of lost your mindfulness. And so then start again at 1. Always start again at 1. And I knew a Zen priest who, when he was practicing in Japan, he was taught to count his breath by his Zen master there. And he was told to count up to 1 and then start again. Yes.
Regarding slowing down and being able to make the choice between getting involved in the thought and not getting involved, is that a choice of actually keeping the thought and observing it, or is it to just let go of the thought entirely?
It can be both. So the advantage of a trained mind that is slow, you know, calm, and can see clearly, and knows what it's like to let go, has developed the muscle of letting go, you have much more choice of what to do. So it could be that sometimes it's just useful to let go. No, thank you, I don't need to do that. Sometimes it's useful to spend time observing the thought and the complex associated with it, because there might be something important there to understand. We don't encourage you to do this in meditation, but there are times in life where it's useful to think. And so you want to have the ability to stay focused. And I'm glad for whatever concentration I have that there are times where I decide I need to reflect on this issue in my life. And so I hold the focus on that for a while. And, you know, I don't get distracted from it. And I think it's very helpful for me. There are other times where I realized that I could let go of thoughts and concerns, but they keep reappearing. And if they keep reappearing, it's usually an indication that there's something important besides a thought that's going on as well. And so then I've said, what I need to do is just observe and watch and let the thought continue, not let go of it, and understand better what's going on, both in terms of the content and the beliefs, and also in terms of the emotional fuel, which is driving the thinking. So with a trained mind, you have greater range of choice of what to do. And so you can, you know, with that range, you can, depending what's useful at a given time, you can then choose. Does that answer your question? Okay. So over here, please.
So I recently had an opportunity to attend the daily life practice with Andrea.
Great.
Which was wonderful.
Uh-huh.
And also a mindfulness-based birth prep class.
Wonderful.
And what something that I got out of both of those classes is that I have a desire to learn more about loving kindness.
Wonderful.
And I was wondering if you could recommend somewhere, or perhaps the podcasts at IMC to go to, to learn more and practice.
Okay, great. Wonderful. In terms of the topic of the talk, loving kindness practice is classically considered a concentration practice. So some people, instead of doing breath meditation, will do loving kindness as a way of developing concentration. And part of the advantage of that is that you get to develop loving kindness at the same time. So it's kind of nice to, you know, dual functions. And loving-kindness is a great practice, and it's a great practice for a mother to have, parents to have, and it's a great thing to do. So to cultivate loving-kindness, there's a classic book in our tradition by Sharon Salzberg called Loving-Kindness, the Revolutionary Art of Happiness. And we might have a copy in the library you can borrow. We do have a number of, like, lots of podcasts. If you go, I think you can just search loving-kindness or metta. I've done some series on that topic, and so you can look at the series. We're going to give instructions as you go through. I think some of the series might actually have handouts that go with it. Andrea Fella has taught day-long retreats here on loving-kindness. I suspect they've been recorded, some of them. She does it once a year. So those are places to go. And then I could mention, since you bring it up, it's not going to teach you anything about loving-kindness, but it's maybe a kind of curiosity thing. Last Monday here, the Monday night, we had a Dharma talk with PowerPoint slide, which is unusual. And the topic of the talk was loving-kindness comes to the West. And it was, I had all these slides showing how this practice of loving-kindness has entered into the West from Buddhism, into our Western society, American society, and from basketball players to Christian colleges to philanthropic funds, and there's a whole series, you know, all kinds of places. And so, you know, if you're interested in the history of loving kindness in this country, maybe it's interesting. Yes, here.
I find that I have difficulty going from a meditative state or something where I come from here to going home to my 2-year-old. I have trouble hanging on or finding peace in the middle of...
Don't hang on.
The chaos.
Don't hang on. Let it go. Let it go and hope that some of the benefit of meditating and being here will somehow carry over without you trying. And there's lots of stories of children who have told their meditating parents, parent, you need to go meditate now. Or then also, I've recently someone told me the story of, I think the child was really encouraging the mother to come here or come to one day sitting or do something, and the mother felt like she couldn't leave it, you know, the responsibility on everybody else in the family, and the child kept saying, you should go. And finally, maybe she said why, the mother said why, or the child said, you're so much a better person when you come back. So, but holding on is hard. And I used to, when I had a 2-year-old at home, I used to stop the car about 2 minutes from my house and sit there and just prepare. And you know, also the other thing, I don't know if you want advice, but the other thing I learned is that sometimes it's really hard with young kids at home. And so you want to make sure that you have support. You know, you're not always in the middle of it. Yes?
I have a question about the practice of mindfulness and metta. And I was mostly focused on metta for quite a while. And then I think, I think I'm losing my mindfulness. And so I went back to mindfulness. But I also, I have a very ruminative mind at times. You know, when the mind just kind of latches on. It was actually happening today. my mind was so ruminative that I could not do mindfulness. And so I got up and thought, okay, so maybe walking might be the approach to this, and just kind of grounding through the feet. And then as I was walking, the kind of the metta started to come. And so it almost seemed like in a ruminative mind, the phrases give it something to hold on to,
right?
As a way to deal with. And, you know, something kind of settled, and I don't know what it was in the end, but that was one of the kind of refreshing things about the metta, that it gives my mind something, and it seems to sometimes work. At the same time, you know, I still want to, there's a part of me that thinks, oh, I'm not as mindful anymore because I'm doing metta.
It could happen, and may we all have that difficulty. It's a good thing. I mean, it's a wonderful thing that you have the metta. as I said earlier, metta is a concentration practice. So it's possible to get quite concentrated doing, very concentrated, and so concentrated and absorbed in that practice that there isn't much, a mindful mind, a mind that has ready for insight, is independent of what's being seen, has some independence rather than being absorbed And so it can happen that you get too concentrated for the purpose of mindfulness. I don't encourage people to not get that absorbed and concentrated, but if what you want is, if you've learned that it's more useful for you to cultivate more mindfulness and support your daily life, then you want to maybe slow down enough with the metta, but don't go too far. And when you reach a certain plateau, a certain level of calm, then you can switch to doing mindfulness, and the mindfulness might be much more effective and kind of have more lasting benefit for you. So you have a choice. You know, you decide what that level of calm is where you want to switch to mindfulness. The other thing you can do is just let yourself get as concentrated as possible, not worry about being mindful in your meditation, but then switch to mindfulness as you come out of the meditation, when you start your life. And try to start your life kind of slowly, so the mindfulness, you have a chance to kind of reintegrate or bring in mindfulness to it.
It's just uncertain, certain times, you know, the rumination doesn't happen all the time, but, you know, in like today, it's sort of like, what do I do when my mind has possessed me, right? It's sort of like, some stressor happens, the mind is really, is sort of like, whoa, it's very hard to detach from this. It's even hard for me to observe it. It's hard for me to be, you know, really feel like I can withstand it in my body. And then I thought, well, okay, maybe it's time for something else at this moment.
Maybe. You know? I think it's very important in meditation to stay close to the ability, or have the ability, cultivate the ability to always pull yourself out of whatever's happening. Mm-hmm. So to, you know, open your eyes, to, you know, stop, to not feel like you're ever stuck in whatever's going on, whether it's a concentration state or whether it's emotional state or whatever. And actually cultivate that ability to come out. Some people find that helpful because otherwise they feel trapped and stuck by all the kinds of things that can happen, and then, you know. But actually, it's a very, very important human strength, capacity, to be able to kind of change our emotional state, get pull out from what's going on. So maybe that's a useful lesson for you to have. And once you have that developed, then maybe it's easier for you to have confidence that you can go in deep, and not get stuck there because you've cultivated the ability to get out. Some people find that a little bit, for people who have strong meditation, some people find that a little unsatisfying, because in some ways it's more satisfying to go deep than it is to go a little bit and then pull out. But developing that is useful to do. The other thing that I recommend is you come and talk to me or another teacher in greater detail what this experience is like when you say you get stuck in there. Because, you know, there's a variety of things it actually could be, and maybe some other time for me to find out, explore it with you. There might be different advice for you. Okay. So, stop and look. What could be more difficult? What could be what could be easier? Stop and look. And it's a great thing to do, to periodically stop and look more carefully. So may all of us stop, look, and develop a soft and kind mind. Thank you.